Money, it makes the world go round. But who's moving that money? Odds are it's private equity. And odds are you have no idea what that means. But that ends this week, because we're speaking with Dave Masterman, a guy who's been in the private equity industry for over a decade. We're talking to him about why private equity even exists, where they get their money, what they do with it, buying and selling of companies, what is good private equity, what is bad private equity. We go into it all. Like, subscribe, share with all your friends. As always, we're learning together. Let's dive in. Hello, 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 and welcome to Colby Howard Wants Your Job, the podcast where we find out what the hell everyone else does with their day. My guest this week, David Masterman. Lovely having you on.
Good to be here.
He is not only private equity associate.
Vice president, but thank you.
VP. On his shoulders rests today not only what he does, but how to explain the entire private equity industry, which he did not know coming in.
Luckily, it's simple.
But he's up to the task. As always, I'm your host, Colby Howard. Let's dive in. Let's start with a very simple question. Like, Dave GPT.
Yeah.
How would you describe private equity to a 10-year-old?
Well, I get this question all the time.
Oh, you do? From 10-year-olds?
From family members, from my mom and dad, who try to describe finance and private equity to their friends without making it seem embarrassing and like I'm a terrible person. So I get this a lot. The easiest way to describe it is, have you seen Shark Tank? Right?
Okay.
People come with
ideas.
Was
I supposed to answer that?
No.
Okay.
I assume you've seen it.
I have.
People come with ideas for companies. Mark Cuban and Mr. Wonderful and the others say, do I want to invest in that company? Hopefully they can make that company better and then realize a return down the road. Same thing that we do in private equity, but we are later stage companies. So companies who are established, who have revenue, who have customers, we come in there and say, oh, this is a really interesting business. Maybe they need capital to go enter a new market. Maybe they need capital to enter a new space in some way. And we say, we'll buy some or all of your business, help you grow it, and then hopefully sell it for more down the road.
I love that. I don't know if that was a 10-year-old, but like definitely an 18-year-old would understand.
I told you
that.
It's simple. We're done. We can podcast over. No problem.
My issue is I grew up around private equity.
Yeah.
My dad's in private equity. I thought I was going to work in private equity, which means...
You look like you work in private equity.
Hey, I appreciate that. It means that I know just enough to think I know how private equity works and probably be wrong about all of it. So we're going to lean in hard on those assumptions.
Cool.
Let's do the whole life cycle of like a deal. Mm-hmm. I did this with Josh Bussin, who's a white-collar criminal defense lawyer. Like, a client comes in to, are they guilty or not guilty? I think there's a little bit of a balance between what it is you do and like how private equity works. But let's start with the people who started your firm had to get money from someone.
Yep.
So you are convincing someone to give you money so that they can get back theoretically more money at a later time. Why are they even giving you money?
The easiest way to think about it is like an endowment. Right. Take Harvard Endowment, who's managing billions and billions of dollars. Their goal on behalf of Harvard's endowment is to appreciate those dollars. Right. And there's a variety of ways to do that. Mm-hmm. You can invest in the public markets, like you or I could go buy stocks and like lose money on Peloton. That I'm sure we all have done. We could go and invest in bonds or invest in private companies individually, like try to go be seed funding venture capitalists. Mm-hmm. And the reality is these endowments do all of that and they diversify. And so part of what they do is they allocate dollars to the private equity market. And those are fund managers whose job, like my job is to find dollars from those endowments, insurance companies, high net worth individuals on occasion, and grow those dollars for them through this private equity strategy. And that means investing in private companies, buying equity in private companies, not public companies. Mm-hmm. So they'll also allocate dollars to hedge funds who are doing public equity strategies where they will take dollars from endowments and insurance companies, et cetera, and go invest in the public markets and realize gains for their clients. Hopefully through those means, we'll do that in the private markets.
I think this is interesting. Yes, there are some terrible human beings
and terrible private equity firms that perhaps have given the whole industry a bad name. Mm-hmm. Politicians love kicking the crap out of it.
Yep.
We can talk about what bad private equity does later. But I do think it's interesting, if you have a pension and are considering retiring that pension, odds are that pension is invested in some way in a private equity firm.
Yep.
And the hope is they will get back more money than they put in so you can get your pension. A firefighter's pension,
mm-hmm.
California Teachers Fund. Like, these are, you don't exist in a vacuum. The whole thing is kind of a whole big network, and people don't realize how connected they are to how well you do.
Totally. And I think the whole idea is that they're not 100%, like the pension is not 100% in a private equity firm or in private equity strategy generally. Right. They are diversified. So, you know, you take the issues that the technology sector has had or the venture capital backed technology sector has had over the last couple of years, those investments that were made in that sector are probably quite down over the last 2 years, broadly speaking. But there are other sectors that are up, and that'll ebb and flow. And so the idea for a pension who wants to protect the dollars and grow them is to diversify that strategy and diversify that risk. And so we part, just like hedge funds are part, just like, you know, more traditional or whatever type of investing is part of that diversification strategy.
So all of a sudden you have money and you need to...
Me, the private equity fund.
You don't have all the money yet.
Not yet.
Yeah. But your firm has money.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing your firm and also you need to then find a company to use that money to buy.
To invest in. Yep.
How are you finding a company that wants to be bought, or maybe doesn't even want to be bought, doesn't even know they want to be bought? How are you even finding these opportunities?
So I've been in private equity now for about a decade. And I think over the course of that decade, this market has largely been pretty efficient, meaning there are representatives out there finding businesses that want private equity dollars, investment bankers, and they're essentially the brokers to this world.
So they're the middlemen that you're going to talk about, hey, do you have anything?
Essentially. So the way I always describe it to people who ask is, like, what do bankers do, right? In my world, bankers are the broker to a company. So if you want to sell your house, you want to buy a house, you don't typically go directly to the owner of that house. You go to the broker who's representing that house, because that broker is going to know the market. They're going to own a good prices. They're going to know who are the likely buyers, what people are likely to want this type of house. We're the same way with companies. So we have relationships with, I don't know, 50, 100 different investment bankers whose job it is to represent companies that want private equity investment. And so we'll go to some of our close banker relationships and say, hey, like, what are you representing right now? Or they'll come to us and say, hey, there's a really interesting business in XYZ industry. It fits your criteria. We really like the management team. They're looking for Y amount of dollars. Come meet them. Or here's a presentation on them. Are you interested in having the next step?
When you say efficient, does that also mean that if they're talking to you, it's too late? Like, is there a concept of, I want to find the guy who, like, it's like hiring. Do you want to hire the person who doesn't have a job or who is looking to make their next move? Or do you want to pull the top engineer from Google who, like, doesn't want to leave? How do you think about that?
Well, what I meant by efficient is, I think back in like the 80s.
Oh, the 80s were a good time for you?
It was like the best 6 months of my entire life. It was sick. So the 80s, I just listened to a podcast with Steve Pagliuca, the Bain Capital chairman. And he was talking about early days of private equity when these were private equity funds finding companies. They were buying stakes in these companies and sort of helping them grow. But there wasn't like this whole market for 50, 100 bankers, you know, hearing that this company wants dollars and then pitching that company, say, let me be your broker. There just weren't 100 private equity firms. There weren't that many investment bankers looking to, you know, represent these companies. And it just wasn't known. And so over the years, as this market has evolved, there's way more dollars in private equity. There's way more private equity funds. There are way more bankers looking to represent companies in this space. So now, if you are a founder of a business, it behooves you to get a broker to sort of navigate that market when you know you want to look for liquidity or an exit. And so we, as private equity funds, love the proprietary deal.
Right.
We always talk about that as, like, we sourced this through a proprietary relationship. Maybe we met a company at a conference, or maybe we got introduced from one of our like operating partners, which is just like an executive in the space. Mm-hmm. And like, oh, I have a buddy who started this business. It's awesome. It's growing. You would like them. Here's an introduction. Those are great. But even then, oftentimes they'll have some sort of advisor helping them with the deal process. And so that's what I mean by efficient, is that no longer you're a $100 million company getting called from me. And they're like, sure, buy me. It's like, oh no, I'm a $100 million company. I know the way to maximize my return is hiring a broker, just like you would with a house.
Right. Are you, so in terms of the industry you look at, are you, you're healthcare focused? And when I say, I mean, healthcare is massive. Like, what is that? You will buy what types of companies, or want to buy what types of companies?
Yeah, so my firm is unique in the sense that we are 100% healthcare focused. There are many other funds out there that have a healthcare group, or they will do healthcare deals. There are other healthcare specific funds out there, but we are 100% healthcare. And by healthcare, we mean really anything that touches the healthcare ecosystem, which is a massive, massive space. What we say when we get on the phone with new individuals who are selling their business, will say it's probably easier to tell you what we don't invest in healthcare, which is we don't invest in biopharmaceutical products. So we're not going to invest in that Cambridge biotech that could be a $1 billion company if their COVID vaccine is approved by FDA, or they could be $0 if it doesn't. We won't take that binary regulatory risk. Same way with medical devices. You know, hey, we have this incredible new spine stent that if it just gets FDA approval, we're going to be the richest people in the world, and you guys can come along for that ride. We won't take that risk.
Wasn't that like Pursuit of Happiness? Wasn't he selling?
Wasn't he selling like refrigerators?
Like an MRI.
Oh,
like a portable MRI.
Boxed MRI. Yeah, I don't think I ever saw that movie, but I like the song. That's the same thing, right?
Moving on from Kid Cudi.
Kid Cudi, yeah.
So you won't take, those are the two areas.
We won't do
you
that.
You won't do, okay.
We won't do that. It's too binary. It's too like, we either win or we lose.
Got it.
What we will do though, is we do a ton of work around the companies that service those providers. So like, we call it pharma services, so businesses that serve biopharma. If Pfizer is trying to come out with a new drug, they have to run the clinical trials. They often won't manage the clinical trials on their own. They'll outsource that
to
what they call the contract research organization. So we'll invest in that contract research organization because they will have a Pfizer study going on. They'll have studies going on all the time, which allows you to sort of protect yourself against, oh, this drug doesn't work, that fell away. Okay, but we have another one coming up. It's just, it's more like it's risk mitigation.
So you're in the space, and who are the types of people that are even getting involved with you? Is it, I've run this for 30 years, it's time to cash out and move on? Is it, or is it, I've reached a point where I need more money, you are the logical person to go to for that money?
I'd say it runs the gamut, right? So one of the businesses I work on two businesses primarily. The first one we bought in 2021 is a pharmacy. It's called a closed door pharmacy. So not like a Rite Aid or a Walgreens where you and I would go in and get our prescriptions, but they actually have relationships with behavioral health facilities. And so they are delivering drugs to there so they can then give them to the patient. So a little bit different, but it's a pharmacy. They get paid for dispensing drugs. The founder of this pharmacy started it and ran it for like 20 years. He's probably late 70s, mid 70s, ready for his next phase of life, right? Has grown it, doesn't want to grind anymore, and is looking to monetize what he's grown. And so there's plenty of ways to do that. But he also, you know, they've got a bunch of employees that they really want to continue to grow. And so his thought was, this should be a private equity buyer, not a bigger pharmacy that's just going to eat my company up and spit it out type of thing.
Interesting, because the bad reputation for private equity is we go in, we invest money, and we literally fire everybody. And that's why there's all these fears. Oh, private equity bought us. I'm probably going to get fired.
Cost synergies.
Synergies.
As we say.
But there probably are bad private equity firms. Again, that's a qualifier that private equity firm might not agree with. But if you are bought by another company, there could be a just as likely or greater likelihood that that is happening because they're buying you for a certain reason, not for the overall business. So like
maybe
that's a risk overall whenever you sell your business.
Right. I mean, again, to go back to the house metaphor, right? You sell your house to someone, they could bulldoze it and build it again, right? Or they could redo the bathroom. Or if you spend all this money making the most beautiful home office, they're like, well, we need a nursery. So like there... once you sell it, it's no longer your business and the new owners can do whatever they want with it. Hopefully to, in our case, we have a fiduciary responsibility to our shareholders to continue to grow the asset and make it better.
What does fiduciary responsibility mean?
We have a responsibility to do what's best for the company and to do what's best for our shareholders by growing the value of their investment.
Got it.
I think that's right. Definitionally speaking, it sounds right.
I've heard various versions of fiduciary. I don't think anyone really knows it.
Yeah, fiduciary sounds smart. Anyway, so the idea being that when we buy a company, we have a really set plan of like, what are we going to do with this company, right? Mm-hmm. We're not just buying it to hold it. We think of ourselves as growth investors, which means that we're trying to get our returns via growth. There are other mechanisms by which you can generate a return. The cost piece of it is one that honestly makes sense, right? If you are a business that is running at, let's say, 10% profit, and we look at it and we say, like, you have way too many this type of person or
private jets.
Way too many private jets, or like way, like you're way over indexed in this product that is making you no money. Like getting rid of that product or decreasing those costs is a way to increase your profitability, mm-hmm. thereby growing the business and doing well. We don't tend to do that as much because if we see that on the front end, we're like, that's not really us. That's not us being good guys. That's just like not our strategy.
Is that harder to do? Which do you think is harder to do? Cut costs or grow?
Man, I mean, cutting costs sounds pretty easy, right?
It does sound pretty easy. Sounds pretty honestly, simple. That would be my answer.
Yeah, right? But I don't know, right? Like you cutting costs means that you are now requiring individuals who had a job.
That's
who,
true.
Who had a responsibility set to now do other things that maybe they've never done before.
Yeah.
Growing is entering a new space or a new state or a new product set.
And everything else could stay the same at the company.
Yeah, but they've never done it before also. So you got to grow. Okay. So I don't think any of this is without risk, right? Usually what it is there's a mix of everything. So we'll go back to the pharmacy, right? So the founder wanted to get some liquidity for himself. So we paid him whatever we paid him. He kept some skin in the game, meaning he kept some dollars in the business. So he was aligned with us to help us.
Well, the structure is interesting. You go in and you will buy 51% to 100%
usually
of a company.
Yep.
51% meaning you can then make decisions.
Yep.
And that money goes to whoever the shareholders are, the owners are of that current business. And when you said skin in the game and liquidity, the owner, who's let's say 75, mm-hmm. he's like, Jesus, I've run this for so long. I want some big payout for all the work.
I
want to buy a boat.
Yeah.
Which are very expensive now. Not like he's not looking for a Boston.
Are they more expensive now than they ever were?
Absolutely.
Oh, really?
Boston, a little 25 horsepower Boston Whaler is still
spending
around.
A lot of time on Nantucket, I can tell.
Looking at other people's boats.
Yeah. I just bought a Subaru, so I'm in the Subaru market.
God, he bought a Subaru.
Yeah.
And we have given
I'm not your typical
crap.
Private equity guy, you know?
Endless crap for buying a Subaru. Oh, God. So that owner takes some money down, but also he's not completely out. You want him to still be involved. He knows the company better than anyone else. So let's say you bought 100% of the company.
Yep.
He cashes out, yes, but you give him some equity in the new company so that if it does well, he makes even more money.
Yeah, I guess the idea is like aligning of incentives, right? Mm-hmm. So if we bought the business for $100, mm-hmm. right? We give you $100 and say like, hey, thanks so much. See you later. Good luck. Or we could be like, hey, you have all this knowledge and know-how and usually the employees are really loyal to you. All these businesses, the employees are the most important pieces of the business. Mm-hmm. You want them to stay motivated. Like that's what makes these businesses mm-hmm. good. And we don't want them to walk out the door with the founder.
Right.
And so sometimes we say, all right, here's 90 or here's 100, reinvest 10 with us, stay on the board of directors with us at times, mm-hmm. Stay as CEO, but we want you to be economically aligned with us. So if we do well, you do well. If we do poorly, you do poorly. Mm-hmm. That works out sometimes. Sometimes it doesn't work out that well. It's hard to be a founder and run the show and have everyone report to you. And then suddenly you have a boss sitting in New York who's 34, you know, like that's a weird thing. And so it sometimes doesn't work that well and sometimes has a real transition mode.
I think there was who was the guy, not Tobey Maguire.
I love Tobey Maguire.
There's that movie with, what's the freaking actor's name?
Cider House Rules.
No, it wasn't Tobey Maguire. And Spider-Man. Dennis Quaid, he comes in as Dennis Quaid's boss. And he's like a private equity. And like, it's all about Dennis Quaid getting used to having like a 34-year-old boss. And then this guy.
The intern with Robert
De Niro? No. And then he also ends up dating his daughter, Topher Grace.
Oh, yeah. Topher Grace is wasn't he that 70s show?
That 70s show.
Yeah. He does look like Tobey Maguire, though.
He does. So I got those.
Is it Win a Day with Tad Hamilton? Is that what you're thinking of?
No, but it's a great movie.
Yeah.
I'll find the movie after. Okay.
Topher Grace. This is good podcast.
It's all getting cut. It's fun. You go in and you are one of, if it's an efficient market, you are one of many people who see a company, and if it's a good opportunity, see that it's a good opportunity.
Yep.
Unless there's like, you think it's everyone thinks it's dog crap, but you see a diamond in the rough.
Yep.
Now they are, the owner of the business is in the position to be like, all right.
Yeah, sell me.
Give me your best price and give me your strategy. What are the other variables as to why they would pick you versus the, let's say, 8 other people that might be interested?
8 could be 80.
Jesus.
Could be 10, could be 3. Mm-hmm. It usually comes down to price, right? But there's a band, right? And a lot of times these companies are worth a lot. And so while, you know, $5 to $10 million band seems huge, it may not be the deciding factor, right? So,
well, how big are these deals that we're talking about?
It really depends. Like, we tend to do deals, I don't know, between 100 and 500 of total value of the business, enterprise value, we call it.
So if it's 200 million is kind of the original asking price, you could see offers for maybe 190.
Yeah. There's not really an asking price.
Okay.
So what they do is, to go back to this broker piece that we were talking about, is a presentation is given to us, a management presentation, or we call a SIM, a confidential information memorandum. And that is basically a company in 40 pages, right? Mm-hmm. Here's what the company does. Here's the management team. Here's the market it operates in. Here's the real value drivers of the business. Here's the competitive differentiators. Here are the high-level financial metrics that you need to just say, like, are you interested or are you not? And if you are, at what value are you interested? And at that point, we will maybe have a conversation with that broker, the banker. We may do some, like, high-level research around the market. We may do, like, an expert call through these expert networks that exist, a GLG, for example. We may talk to our network of individuals who are sort of in that space or around that space. And we sort of come up with our view of what we think this business is worth and what we think we will pay for it. Obviously, that entails some like financial modeling, some, you know, projections, what we really think this could do. But keep in mind, all we really know about this business is this like 50-page deck. So it's
How much do you trust it?
You trust the historicals, of course. The projections, that's sort of where the art comes in, right? Like, you can't just blanket be like, well, these are banker projections. We're going to cut them by 20%. It's like you have to, as the investor, think, what can you do with the business? What can you drive as a return? Where do you think that like us as a fund is well positioned to be the right buyer or the right partner for this business?
And for how long are you aiming or thinking you're going to hold it after you buy it?
It's usually 5 years, but can it be anywhere 3 to 7? It's typically our hold.
So you're looking at a company and you're wondering, what can I do with this over the next 5 years?
Yep.
Which is a long time.
It's a long time, but it goes by fast. Well, just to go back to what you were saying before, what are the factors that an owner is evaluating when it comes to picking a partner? I think there's obviously price, but there's a band. There's obviously sort of what you want to do with the business. So if I said to you, Colby, I want you to take your $100 million or take your $100 and bounce, but you're like, well, I really want to be part of it, that's going to put me at a disadvantage.
Right.
I could say, all right, I see the next venture for this business is like, we're going to pivot this and we're going to hit Asia. Like, that's the market. And you're like, no, I don't vibe with that at all. So it's like, that's going to put us at a disadvantage. Or like, strategy could be good. Price could be good. And you get in the room with whoever the buyer is as a founder, and they're just kind of an asshole. And it's like, well, I don't want this guy to be my partner or this woman to be my partner for the next 5 years and grow this thing. And this is my baby. Like, I trust someone with it. And so all those things, I've never sold a business to private equity, but I can imagine that all those things go into the decision of, who do I really want my partner to be? We've heard before that we are the preferred party right? Again, this is the broker talking, so it's hard to know what's true. But we're the preferred party because they want to work with you. They like our style, the way we think about it, but you're too far down on price for it to be competitive. Can you get up on price?
Which is partly negotiation on their
part.
Partly
negotiation, partly like maybe true because we've been like, sorry, we can't move. And they're like, all right, thanks. We're going to go with another buyer. Other times they're like, okay, we're going to take it back to our client, see what they say. Usually when they say we're low on price, the bankers aren't one to jerk us around because they want us to hire them to sell our companies.
Right.
So there's a two-way street and there's trust and loyalty. And, you know, we all understand we're all doing, trying to do the right job for our client or if, in our case, our investors. But there's also like a, you know, a relationship and you want that relationship to continue.
So all those ecosystem that you work in,
right?
Where if you do something bad, you might get away with it once, but you can't get away with it two times.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about it before. We're like, man, these bankers dropped the ball on that one. That was tough. We're like, we let them run our company, run the process for sale of our company. And like, they really boofed it. Like it's going to be tough to give them another one.
Right.
Right. Similarly, like if we buy a company from a banker and we're assholes and we run the business into the ground or during diligence, which is like a really trying and exhausting process, which I'm sure we can talk about. If we're dicks, they're going to be like, man, these guys are not that good to work with. And their next client, they're going to be like, oh, these guys seem cool. They're like, yes, but be wary. It was a really tough diligence process. So think twice.
Got it.
Maybe go with these guys who we know are really clean and simple and do what they say and go by the contract and blah, blah, blah.
I forgot about the diligence process. You got a book. You believed the book. They said, hey, great. We love your price. We love you. Let's move forward. You don't give them money yet because you need to figure out what? Were they lying? How good is the, like, what exactly is the diligence trying to accomplish?
Yeah. So just from a, from like a staging standpoint, we get the book. We're like, hey, we're excited. It's interesting. We put forth an indication of interest, which is a non-binding, which means that like we can put this bid in, but it doesn't mean we have to buy it. Letter. So it says like, dear madam, we like, thank you so much for sending us this, blah, 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 blah. This is why we are the right partner. Here's the value. And we just hope to get time with the management team, which we call a management presentation or management meeting, which will be like a 4-hour day where we go, we meet them in person. Oftentimes it's either followed by lunch or followed by dinner to like get to know them as people. And we're walking through the business, right? Usually before that we come with, I usually say this to like the associates, that there are really like five questions that you should be distilling your diligence down into that are like core go or no go questions. The reality is there are like hundreds, but like the core ones that you really need to figure out.
That if answered negatively, you should scuttle
you
the
should
deal.
Bail.
Okay.
Or even if one of them are answered negatively.
Got it.
Right. One is like customer concentration, meaning to go back to the pharma example, right? If all of your business is Pfizer, right? So 90% of your business is Pfizer. And then for some reason, the Pfizer head of strategic partnerships retires and a new guy comes in. He's got a buddy at another firm. Suddenly you lose the deal. It's like, that's a big risk.
It's like a Apple iPhone provider. It's 100% of your business.
Yeah,
and like, Apple could be like, we're going to Vietnam. Sorry.
Exactly. So it's, dang. Like, that's it. Right? And they're going to shut down. So like those type of threshold questions can really be distilled down into like 5 to 7 usually. But oftentimes they're not as simple as that. It's more like, can we back this management team, right? And that can be more amorphous an answer, right? It's not numbers, it's, you know, do we
if you told them that you were going to keep them.
Yeah, right.
And that they told you we are going to stay.
Yeah, usually, I would say, usually the management team stays.
Okay.
And that we're investing behind a management team. It's rare, at least for us, it's not the case with all private equity funds, that we come in and we say we're replacing the team. We have our CEO, CFO, and COO, waiting in the wings, and we're going to drop them in. People do that. It's just not something we employ. That being said, it is often where if a founder is there, maybe they'll transition, or maybe the business gets big and we'll want to shift the CEO into a board role and bring in a more seasoned CEO. So all those things are in play. But anyways, after the IOI, after the management presentation, we ask these questions, we go through the business, then we'll usually get access to like a ton of information, financial information, operating information.
And why? And they didn't provide that to you before because there was like they don't want that information just getting out.
I think so, probably. And also, like you're trying to create momentum in a process, right? So it's almost like leaving breadcrumbs, right? Sometimes we'll have a conversation with the management team or the banker being like, hey, do you have customer information? Like, yeah, we're going to release that after the management meeting.
Got
right?
it.
Because we think the management meeting is going to get you super excited. And then once you see the customers, you're going to be like, I'm freaking in, mm-hmm. right? So you're kind of trying to develop this momentum. And that's like, again, the home buying thing, right? Like, be like, hey, here's the basement. Here's the bathroom. Here's the kitchen. But like, wait till you see the garden. It's and sick.
Hopefully you don't see that our chimney is crumbling.
Right, exactly.
When you see it,
but like, this is super easy.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like, this is probably not the nicest part of the house, but really like, we have two or three things that we're going to rectify it with and don't even worry about it. Right. So that's part of it. So we go through that whole process and we'll do a lot of work on our own in advance of what we call the LOI phase, the letter of intent phase, which usually means that we're going to be the only existing buyer looking at the business. That means going under exclusivity. Mm-hmm. So we're the exclusive buyer where we really do intense diligence. And by that, I mean, we spend money on third parties, accounting firms to make sure all their financials are real and backable mm-hmm. and supported and compliant and everything. Lawyers to review every single contract, every single customer contract, every single, you know, regulatory thing is in order because we don't want to step into any liability. Also, they'll do all the purchase documentation, all the operating agreements. So everything has how our decisions made, right? So you asked, you talked early about usually we'll buy 51% to control the company. Really, that's just part of the operating agreement. We can buy 1% of the company, but if the operating agreement says we are, have governance rights for everything, we have governance rights for everything.
Interesting.
Or if you buy 99%, but the founder still has rights for X, Y, or Z, veto power, et cetera. Those are all written into the legal documents. And so that's a whole lawyer thing. We'll hire like specialists, you know, like environmental specialists to go and see like, are we non-compliant in X, Y, or Z? We'll hire insurance brokers to make sure that we're insured, like cybersecurity and things like that. We'll hire, we'll go out to lenders. If you want to talk about leverage, oftentimes,
not yet.
Oftentimes we finance this with debt. So we'll bring in lenders to help us finance the deal. And so there's a whole slew of money being spent on our side to make sure that we're covering all our bases and we're not walking into something that we don't want.
And up to this point, how has Dave Masterman been involved?
I'm a mid-level is what they call it. There's the partner, there are the mid-levels, which are usually principal and vice president, and then there are the associates who are sort of the junior team. And I really do sit in between both. And by that, I mean, I'm in the data, I'm in the diligence, even though most of the modeling and actual analysis is being done by the associate who had just come out of investment banking. And then I'm also trying to think about like, what are we trying to understand? I'm asking the question, I'm originating the analyses, and I'm helping the associate do that. So that's down, right? Then up, I'm thinking, what are the key questions, right? How do I articulate this? Do we really want this company? What is our investment thesis? And I'm doing that in conjunction with the partner, but largely driven by the partner, right? So we are talking about it together. We're thinking like, all right, pricing. He sometimes will say to me like, all right, what do you think? What do you think we should pay for this? And I'm like, let's say 100 to 120. And he's like, I'd say 90 to 110. And I'm like, yeah. You know, like not that simple, but like that's the kind of things where like, the more higher level driving the strategic questions, a lot of the relationship stuff takes place at the partner level. And the reality is the partner just comes with 20 plus years of seeing these types of businesses over and over again. And I'm sort of apprenticing in that way, which is learning from the things he notices, you know, trying to preempt what question I think he will ask by working with the associate to answer those questions in advance and advance the deal forward.
The company or your firm also has to, like, there's an internal pitching process, right? You found something, you think it's great. What's the approval process inside? Yeah.
So they call that investment committee, right? So every private equity fund has an investment committee, usually made up of the senior leaders at the organization. Not every partner works on every deal. There's a deal partner and a deal team. So usually for us, it's three. It's deal partner, mid-level, myself, or one of the other VPs or principals, and an associate. And the three of us are running the deal, and we know everything that's going on with the deal. Every Monday, we talk as a team. We go through each and every opportunity we're looking at. Everything from we just got a teaser, which is what you get before the SIM. We got a SIM in. We had a management meeting. We submitted an IOI. We submitted an LOI. We're in diligence. This is our portfolio company. All that whole thing, we go through every single one, every single Monday. It doesn't take that long. It takes like an hour, mm-hmm. hour and a half. But we go through everyone, so everyone's sort of up to speed. But when we're going to make a new investment, we present to the team, we want to buy ABC Corp. Here are the reasons why we think it's a really good deal. Here's how we came up with our valuation. Here's all the diligence we have done. Here's investment merits. Here are investment risks. Here are our mitigants for those risks. Here's our financial projection model. Mm-hmm. Here's sort of a sensitivity analysis, which means if this happens, here's our returns. If that happens, here are our returns. And getting the team sort of up to speed. For us, we're a pretty small group. There's only about 15 investment professionals on the team, four partners. And so those four partners make the decision. And they talk all the time. We talk to everyone all the time. They all know what's going on. At bigger funds and funds that I've been in the past, it's a much larger group of investment committee members. So people that aren't plugged in and aren't in those Monday meetings. And so those investment committee meetings can be long yeah. and challenging, and they're trying to poke holes. Because at the end of the day, it's usually the private equity fund, actually always, will have their own dollars at risk. And so if you are a partner in a different part of the fund mm-hmm. that doesn't know anything about these,
got it.
They're writing a check in this business and they're like, well, I don't believe you. This mm-hmm. like, did you think about this? Did you think about that? How did you get around this? What did the lawyer say about that?
So it's A to Z for the first time for this one person.
For this one person.
To pitch them
yeah.
on a thing that you've been working on for 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
And they might just say no.
They may say no. I've never been in a conversation where like they would say no to me. I've been too mm-hmm. junior. But usually, or at least at the fund I'm referring to, my first job, they would preempt this knowing they're like, oh, you know, like George always has, he's a freaking stickler for this type of business. So I'm going to get lunch with George beforehand and walk him through this. I'm going to preempt it.
Got it. You're managing the process right, internally.
Exactly. And so that's the sale process internally. But fortunately for us, we're a small enough firm from a people standpoint, and the partners seem to be really well aligned, and we all only do healthcare. So it's easier to understand it all.
And so you successfully buy a business.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
You now have 5 to 7 years to grow that business, make it worth more,
yeah.
have someone buy it from you. Your investors are like, fantastic. I now have more money than what I gave you. And then you take a fee of that if you do well. Is that essentially it?
Yeah. So it's called the 2-20 model, mm-hmm. right? 2% management fee, 20% carried interest. So the idea being, let's say you're a $100 million fund for managing, and we're just talking about private equity mm-hmm. compensation, how funds are actually compensated for what they do. We have a $100 million fund. We'll take a 2% fee on that just for managing the dollars. Just like if you put your money with a wealth manager or Fidelity or whoever, they're going to charge you a little fee just for managing that.
Mm-hmm.
And then for us, when we generate a profit, so we bought a business for 100, we called capital, we called dollars from all of our investors, we executed the deal, we grew it. 5 years later, we made $200 million, right? We'll send the $100 million back, say like, hey, thanks so much. Here's your dollars back. And then we'll send 80% of the profit. So we'll send $80 million back to everyone else and we keep 20.
And the reason, because that could sound absurd.
Yeah.
You keep 20. Granted, that's how venture capital works, how hedge funds work. It's just how people who invest, that's how it's played out. You could have put that money, and maybe you should have, if it doesn't go well, maybe. In the S&P 500.
Yep.
And after 5 years, the S&P 500 has gone up 50%, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
You are basically saying, if you had given it to us, it would have been 100%.
Yeah.
We'll take 20.
Yeah.
And you get to keep 80. So now your return is 80% as opposed to 50. You are much better off, which is why we are worth that 20. Is that essentially the pitch?
That's the idea. But again, like going back to our initial conversation about why like a pension or an endowment would invest some, it's risk mitigation, right? So they are still putting dollars in the S&P because there's definitely there's value to having just exposure to many different strategies. For us, we say we underwrite our deals to 3x returns, right? We don't always hit 3x, but on average, we tend to settle out onto 3x.
So on a percentage basis.
So you put 100 in, we get 300 out.
Mm-hmm.
So that's over 5 to 7 years. That's where we've been shaking out. That's very good.
That's a hell of a lot better than the stock market.
That's better than the stock market, but it's higher risk than the stock market mm-hmm. too, right? And it's locked up. It's illiquid. So you Got send it. Your dollars to us, you're not going to see that. And you have very little control of when you
until
see
you,
that.
Until you sell that company.
And so, you know, for someone like me who is an investor in the fund, the first 5 years of a fund cycle is cash out the door, cash out the door, cash out the door. And we don't realize those investments, meaning we don't sell those investments and generate a return until 5 years later. Mm-hmm. So it's a different model of you're just totally illiquid as a big, especially if you're writing $100 million right. into a fund. It's just a different thing.
After you buy the company, mm-hmm. okay, you're on the clock. You got 5 to 7 years.
Yeah.
You want it to be worth a lot, 3 times what it's worth now. You are giving them more money than they had to spend on things that you and them think will make money.
Yep.
And so how involved are you over the next 5 years?
Really involved.
Okay.
Really involved. And again, that's fund specific. There are way more passive investors. Venture capitalists tend to be much more passive. They may introduce you to someone, but they're not really, they have a diverse amount of investments across their portfolio. We are very concentrated, which means in our $1 billion fund, we may only have 10 companies. So we really need all 10 to do well.
Uh-huh.
And so we focus on them and we sit on the board and we are active on a daily basis.
And you are assuming, you like to think that you're good at this.
Well, like we would hope.
You're good at running a business.
Yeah. Well, we're not running it. It's interesting. It's a different thing. It's like we are holding the individuals accountable for running the business, which where they haven't been in the past. So for example, for one of our companies, we've seen our profit margin decrease, right? And if you're a founder, you can just be like, shoot,
yep,
our profit margin is decreasing. Oh, well, I'm still taking $1 million out of the business right. every year. No big deal. We'll rectify that next year. No problem. For us, we're like, what is happening? How do we figure that out?
Right.
What is this trend? What's happening with that trend? Provide us answers.
Is there a world here where this is actually a great analogy. So I think it was Blackstone bought Spanx.
Mm-hmm.
And Spanx gave them a bunch of data before they bought them. They were able to use much more sophisticated data science and a whole bunch of business projections because Spanx wasn't as sophisticated as yeah. Blackstone is.
Yeah.
That they were able to find correlations of, oh, I didn't realize everyone who buys this pant buys these leggings. And like, there's so much to do here that Spanx doesn't know about
mm-hmm.
because you're more sophisticated. Yeah. Not that Spanx is dumb. They right. did incredibly well. They're an incredible brand. But you're coming in, you've seen a ton of situations. That founder of that company who's running it is very good and has been very good at that thing. And you can bring perhaps strategy or a toolkit mm-hmm. or maybe it's data science. Maybe it's other sophisticated advisors
yeah.
to basically give them the best chance they've ever had to succeed.
Yeah, we sort of come as like lighter fluid, right? Mm-hmm. It just we're gonna supercharge growth because as a founder, anything you need to do is coming out of your pocket, right? You like, oh, yeah, you want to hire yeah. 3 sales force members? Like, you know, we hear all the time like the demand is there. I just can't hire this many people. I don't have the dollars, and so we're like, no problem, let's do it.
Here's
rip,
some money.
Rip, right? Or like we are. You know, we often grow through M&A, through mergers and acquisitions.
Is that considered a roll-up?
We like to say these are strategic acquisitions. There are strategies that are roll-up strategies where it's like the investment committee memo we talked about, right? When you're presenting to the investment committee, so much of it is how are you going to grow this thing? How are you going to do well with it? Some strategies are there are 25 small acquisitions that we're going to make. No problem. We know them all. We're all good. That's like dental businesses. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the audience, the listeners know these dental roll-ups, but it's a massive private equity play where you buy one, then you buy two, and then it becomes like a 50 office dental business.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many single practice dentists, it's really easy to do that. For this pharmacy business, that wasn't our strategy. It was growing organically because we knew we had beats on good customers outside of our market that we could get to through sales forces or whatever. But we also knew that there was a chance for strategic acquisitions. The thing with acquisitions are it's not that easy to get a deal done.
No, it's messy.
It's messy. It's hard bringing cultures together, bringing people together, dealing with founder dynamics, coming to a price that is exciting to a founder. And especially when you have a small window of time to do it in, it is tough to be price disciplined where you're like, well, this would be mm-hmm. amazing for the business. screw it, we'll pay $20 million more. Like, you can't do that because then you're behind the eight ball and it's no good.
All right. When people think about bad private equity, I think the what people think about is a ton of debt and like Elon Musk. This is perfect.
Yep.
Elon Musk could be a private equity firm.
Mm-hmm.
He went into Twitter with a ton of debt.
Yep.
And now he needs to pay the interest on that debt.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're looking at Twitter, you're like, that's probably why he's firing everyone. That's not what he will say is the reason he's firing everybody.
Yeah.
But the ton of debt, fire everybody so you can pay off the debt so you can make a ton more money if the business does well at all.
Yep.
Is that the bad private equity reputation, would you think?
Well, I think there's many instances of bad private equity, let's say. That could be one of them, right? But I would argue that if the business succeeds and Elon is able to turn that company around and re-strategize, and maybe that is a ton of layoffs, but if that business is sustainable in the future, that's not necessarily bad. It may be distasteful, I guess, or challenging for the individuals that were laid off. But like, maybe that is what the business needed. Maybe Twitter got so bloated and so whatever that like maybe that's what it needed. And it's just like took someone to come in and, you know, shake the cage a little bit. I don't know that I believe that. Who knows?
Time
will tell.
That would be the thesis.
That would be the thesis that he's operating on. I don't think Elon went in there was being like, I'm going to be a dick and I'm going to fire everyone.
I mean, there's a chance that's going that way.
But I think the bad private equity really, especially in our space, is ethical, right? And it's... There are ways to make money in healthcare specifically that are not best for the patient. In healthcare in particular, I am like very careful to sniff out bad actors because there are bad actors in this space for sure. And the question is, are you as a private equity fund backing and growing businesses that are, we say, like doing well by doing good, right? Like, are you
It's a good slogan.
Are you actually doing that or are you just trying to find the next dollar? For, you know, pain management businesses, right? Pain management makes a ton of dollars. These are people with chronic back pains who not only go for physical therapy, but they go for back surgeries, which are very expensive and very lucrative. They get prescribed opioids a lot. And so you've seen a lot of businesses, a lot of pain management practices that turn into pill mills where people who are addicted to opioids will go get their back pain and then just collect prescriptions.
Which make a ton of money.
Which make a ton of money.
But not the right way.
But bad news, right? Just bad for the broader system. And so that is what I would say is bad private equity and bad business, which is you're supporting businesses that are not ethically what you want to be supporting. And I think as healthcare investors, we always talk about driving value to the system, more value to the system for every dollar spent. Obviously, the healthcare expenditures in this country are insane. And so can we support businesses that are driving efficiencies in the market? And what does efficiencies mean? Better outcomes, right? Healthier people lead to less use of healthcare, more efficient processes. So you don't have to go to stakeholder A, B, C, D, E. You can just go A to E. Like maybe that helps.
Right.
Better technologies to make sure that these patients are getting the care early or make sure that the care they are getting are effective. Reaching patients before they get really sick. We own a chronic kidney disease business that does population management and trying to figure out using data and using sort of forward-looking demographic data and things like that, trying to predict who is likely to get CKD before they hit stage four, stage five, so they don't need to be on dialysis their whole life, which dialysis is incredibly expensive and brutal for the patients. That limits healthcare expenditures, which also is good for the patients, right? And so—
And the business.
And so it's not necessarily altruism,
right?
We are not out here, we are for profit and we are a finance organization, but there are ways to invest in healthcare that I think drive the healthcare as a industry and as sort of a mechanism for health, which is what it should be, forward while also turning a profit, which is the way the system works. That's why capitalism works.
That is just a fantastic place to end. Dave Masterman, awesome having you on.
Glad to be here.
Lovely.
Lovely.
I learned a ton. I thought I knew a lot. Turns out I didn't. Hopefully you did too. This has been Colby Howard Wants Your Job. Can't wait to talk to you guys next week. See ya.
See ya.